Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures. For more than 50 years, the museum has told stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character. Details at texancultures.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Every 4 years, we have a presidential election in November, and then a few weeks later, there is the real election. That's when the Electoral College meets and they pick the president based on how each state voted. It's a system that works, except sometimes when it doesn't. Here's late night comic Stephen Colbert in November 2016.
Now, a lot of worried people out there are trying to keep Trump from being president, even at this point. In fact, a member of the Electoral College named Christopher Suprun just wrote an op-ed titled, "Why I Will Not Cast My Electoral Vote for Donald Trump." Suprun says Trump is unfit for office, and as evidence, he cites Donald Trump. This makes Suprun what's called a faithless elector. Also the name of a Lifetime movie about a wife who discovers her husband is having an affair with a voting machine. This guy suggests that instead of Trump, Republican electors should vote for someone like Governor John Kasich of Ohio. Oh, come on. It's a protest vote. You can pick anyone on the planet, and you choose John Kasich. That's like a genie giving you three wishes and saying, "I'll take three Old Navy gift cards, please."
Now there is a question about faithless electors going to the U.S. Supreme Court. What does this mean for representative democracy or popular sovereignty or even having some sort of government that we can say was actually legitimately elected? We're going to be talking about faithless electors and the Electoral College today on The Source. You can call in with your questions and comments. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet at us at @tprsource. We're joined this hour by George Edwards, a Texas A&M political science professor and an expert on the Electoral College. Professor George Edwards, welcome to The Source.
Thank you very much.
Also with us, Jesse Wegman. He's a New York Times editorial board member, author of the forthcoming book, Let the People Pick the President, the case for abolishing the Electoral College. And Jesse Wegman, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us is Eugene Mazo, election law scholar and visiting associate professor of law at Rutgers University. And Gene Mazo, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me as well.
So, Jesse Wegman, you got a book saying the Electoral College needs to go. So, what faithless electors? Tell me what's your take on that.
Sure. You know, it's clearly an issue at the front of people's minds right now because the Supreme Court just granted these two cases to decide a specific issue about them. I have to say, and I've said this in writing for the Times and elsewhere, but I actually don't think faithless electors are the heart of the problem with the Electoral College. They are a significant issue, and we're going to talk about just why, but I don't think that in the end, faithless electors are going to decide any election, even a close election. They never have in the past, and I think there's pretty obvious reasons for that, which we can get into. So I think that when you look at how faithless electors function and what was the intent, what their intent was in the first place, it's not going to decide the outcome of any presidential race.
So. We learned a lot in civics class about how the government functions, and now here we are in 2020. We've learned that none of that actually is true, and so we don't have checks and balances. The president is above the law, all these other things we now actually know for real. So why do we have Electoral College for real? Tell me what they told us in grade school, George Edwards.
Well, I'm not sure what they told you in grade school, but that they may have told you something about the founders, and they were probably wrong about what they told you. The founders had a great many motivations, none of which were uniformly held in the Constitutional Convention, and they were just tired. They couldn't figure out what to do. They voted one way and another way and another way, and finally they just cobbled this together at the last minute. And because they weren't sure that they could handle a direct election of the president, some feared the president had too much power, some feared people were too ignorant, some people just feared democracy. So they just cobbled this together with intermediaries expecting electors to have discretion. And, of course, it hasn't worked out that way at all. And none of the original motivations are relevant today, I might add. That none of them hold. And so there's really no justification. There's no justification for the Electoral College. There's certainly no justification for individual electors.
And Gene Mazo at Rutgers University, we have this, an artifact from the founding of the country, and we're basically stuck with it, right?
We are stuck with it. I would say it's actually not from the founding of the country. It's from 1804. The original framers did something slightly different from the Electoral College. There was a slightly different system where electors initially cast two votes, and the one who got the most votes became the president, the second most became the vice president. And in 1803, Congress saw what happened the first four elections. In 1804, we adopted the 12th Amendment, which slightly changed the way we elect a president. Then electors started casting two votes, one for president, one for vice president. It's because we had a tied election. And Thomas Jefferson, we had a tied election the cycle before in 1800. And the framers, not our original framers, but 12 years in 1804, they wanted to change the system and how it works. So the Electoral College as it works now actually wasn't exactly from the founding. It came once we had run four elections.
So the issue really is, this is the system that we do have, and this is going to play a role in who gets to be the president of the United States. And is this going to reflect the popular will of the people? That still is an important concept that needs to be, it's a part of legitimacy of a president, is it not, Professor George Edwards?
Well, it certainly is. And because we saw an example of George W. Bush where even several years into his presidency and even after the big rally after 9/11, the rally in presidential approval, there was still a substantial percentage of the people who didn't think he was legitimately elected president of the United States. And of course, Donald Trump, who lost the popular vote by almost 3 million votes, has never had majority approval of the public. So, I mean, there are many reasons for that. But he started on a weak basis because he clearly lost the popular vote. So right away, it puts a president in a hole.
And Jesse Wegman, how much I've heard, and maybe you can help me understand this, you could actually win the Electoral College with about a quarter of the popular vote, with 25% of the vote. Is that right?
Sure. I mean, just because of the nature of voting turnout in America, you know, we top out at 55 to high 50 percentage, area these days. Any president who wins the election, whether or not he or she wins the popular vote, is going to win in that 25 to 30 range. But yes, it certainly raises serious concerns when someone who's winning a quarter of the eligible voters in the country and not even the plurality of those votes.
Sure, president. They could cobble together all of the small states and come up with 270 electoral votes and win the presidency. But of course, that's a challenge in and of itself. But it exposes a theoretical weakness that we have in our system. And is this something that can be shored up, or is this something that can be exploited down the line? That's what the Supreme Court could weigh in on as they explore this issue of faithless electors. We're taking a break. The number is 210-614-8980. The Source continues. Well, Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about how we elect a president, and we do have a national election, but really what it comes down to are the electors and our electoral college, and if you can get 270 of them to put your name in the box, then you become president of the United States. And how that works, some say, is actually flies in the face of what our nation stands for. It doesn't really work in conjunction with what we call popular sovereignty, that the power of our government, of our chief executive, comes from the people. What do you have to say about that? Are you concerned? Do you think it can be changed? What kind of system would you support? The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. In the U.S. Constitution, it says very little about this, but it does say that it's the states that decide who gets to be these electors. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature therefore may direct a number of electors equal to the number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled to in Congress. So the state government has a lot of power on this. So we now have a caller, a state senator, Jose Menendez. And Senator Menendez, welcome to The Source. And what is your take on this?
Hey, thanks, David Martin. David, I love listening to your show. I'm frustrated because I'll tell you, after the last election, when the current president was beaten by over 3 million votes in the popular vote, people could not understand why how he had come. You know, people intellectually, you can understand this system, but the question is, why do we still have this relic still around? And I heard your two guests talk earlier that, you know, earlier they couldn't trust whether or not they could handle this election. We're in a day and age where information is almost instant, and people are up to date and speed on what's happening. And I think people can make their own minds, and they would want to represent that their votes make the difference. Because I get frustrated in many that we try to encourage people to go show up to vote, and if they believe that it doesn't matter if they vote because there's some nebulous electoral college is going to make the final decision, well, then that's just going to make getting people who feel disenfranchised that much harder to get out to vote.
All right. State Senator Jose Menendez, thanks for calling in with your take on that. And he says it's time for the electoral college to be replaced and done away with and let the people vote. Jesse Wegman, that sounds like the title of your book, Let the People Pick the President, the Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. Now, we have a constitution. It's in the constitution. Having to change the constitution requires states to weigh in on this. And many states are not going to go along with this because they see the electoral college, particularly small states, as protecting them. So how would you work around that?
Well, the quick answer to that is there's something called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which is underway right now and has been going on for about 15 years, in which states agree to award all of their electors to the candidate who wins the most votes in the country, not the candidate who wins the most votes in their state. And once states representing a majority of electoral votes sign on to that compact, it kicks in, and that would guarantee the presidency to the person who wins the most votes in the country. So that's actually using the language of the Electoral College that you read from in the Constitution, in Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution, to implement a national popular vote without actually abolishing the college. But could I just step back for a minute just to explain a couple of things? Because I think a lot of people's feelings about the Electoral College and about electors stems from some basic misunderstandings or incomplete understandings, and I think it would just be helpful to clarify a couple of just key points right up front. And the first one is that you, as a citizen, as a voter, you have no constitutional right to play any role at all in the process of electing the president. Nothing. You certainly don't have a right to vote directly for the president. We've made that clear. But you don't even have a right to vote for your electors. As you read from the passage in the Constitution, the decision for how to appoint electors is entirely in the hands of the state legislature. If the state legislature decides, as many state legislatures did in the early years of the country, to appoint those electors themselves and leave the voters out of it entirely, they can do that. That's entirely constitutional. So I think it's important for people to remember that they have no constitutional right at all to play any role in electing the president. And the second just quick point I would make is, you know, there's a sense that electors just kind of exist out there. They're this neutral body of people waiting for their, you know, either for inspiration to strike or to deliberate over what the people have said in the ballot box. And in fact, that's not the case. There's actually every candidate who's running in any state has their own slate of electors. So in Texas, I think you have 38 electors in Texas, mm-hmm. right? There aren't 38 presidential electors waiting to cast Texas's electoral votes. Each candidate has his or her own slate of electors. Donald Trump had 38, Hillary Clinton had 38, and whoever else was on the ballot in 2016 had 38. So when the person who wins the most votes in the state goes, you know, whoever wins the most votes in the state, that candidate's electors go to the state capitol in December to cast their votes for president. And that's why I'm saying that I don't think that faithless electors are going to be a big deal, because the electors are motivated to vote for the person that they have agreed to vote for.
Right. So that gets down to how the sausage is made. Professor George Edwards from Texas A&M, political science professor, you're an expert on the Electoral College. This issue of faithless electors, or some people have called them Hamilton electors, where they are not directly going to just rubber stamp what it is that the popular vote decided in the state. Why is that? I mean, if suddenly that became the norm, we say, okay, you could do whatever you want. You're unhinged. You go for it. If that were to become the system, would that be better or worse for, you know, coming up with a representative democracy?
Well, I don't think there's any way to justify giving some people that we really know almost nothing about discretion to choose the president. And that's why faithless electors are such a problem, a potential problem. Now, between 1872 and the last election in 2016, there was never more than one a year. So it really, as Jesse said, it was just rounding error. In the last election, there were seven. Four in Washington, two in Colorado, one in Hawaii, and there were several others who had to be replaced, including them in Texas, who couldn't stomach Donald Trump. Although it turns out that the Washington electors and the Hawaii elector voted for someone other than Hillary Clinton, and they were Democratic electors. So nobody really thinks that's a good idea to have the potential for faithless electors. I mean, even advocates of the Electoral College can't support a faithless elector. My book on Electoral College is Why the Electoral College is Bad for America. So you know where I stand. I think we should get rid of it entirely. But the easiest change to the Electoral College, the simplest improvement, which might have universal appeal, would be to get rid of the potential of electors. You don't need to have electors. They really don't have any useful role. I mean, even if you kept electoral votes, which I oppose, but even if you did, you could get rid of the electors, and we ought to.
So the only requirements we have on electors is that they are not elected officials. They have to be. They can't be holding office. Is that what we, Professor Edwards?
Yeah, that's about it. I mean, each state has rules to choose their electors, and the states typically shift this to the party. So the parties come up with a slate for their candidate. And the slate that actually gets to vote is the slate representing the party which came in first in the presidential election. So they're the ones who go in December actually to the state capitol and cast their electoral votes. But there's very few qualifications for these people. In fact, there's a couple of disqualifications, as you said, but there's really no real qualifications.
So the Constitution says no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector. So Professor Edwards, why that, you know, why that bar?
Well, I think they didn't want the collusion of like Congress selecting selecting the president if members of Congress were also electors. So they didn't want legislative intrigue. In fact, one of the reasons that they didn't choose a president being selected by the legislature is exactly that. And they looked at parliamentary systems. They didn't like it, for better or worse. They chose not to have that. So they wanted an independent elected executive, independent of the legislature.
And but Jesse Wegman, these are tend to be people who are extreme party loyalists. They've donated quite a bit to the party. Some have said it's a collection of political hacks. Is that a good accurate description?
It depends on who we're talking about here. Bill Clinton was a presidential elector for New York in 2016. I guess some people would consider him a presidential hack. I mean, a political hack. But and then someone like Michael Baca is at the other end of the spectrum. Michael Baca was the a Democratic elector from Colorado who is the named plaintiff in the suit, or I guess now he's the respondent in the suit out of Colorado. He was one of the Hamilton electors, I think, as Professor Edwards said, who decided to try to get this movement underway where they would convince enough Republican pledged electors around the country to vote for someone other than Donald Trump as a way to keep Donald Trump out of office. And so Michael Baca, you know, he was, I think, his story opens my book. He was an Uber and Lyft driver in Denver during that year. He was 24 years old, a former Marine, and had no political experience whatsoever. I'm not sure I would call him a hack. He's now a high school civics teacher. But yes, the range of people who can be chosen is really remarkably wide. There's a James Michener, the famous novelist, was a presidential elector in 1968, and he tells a story in his book called Presidential Lottery, in which he also calls for the abolishing of the Electoral College for somewhat different reasons than we're talking about today. He describes the scene in which he's chosen to be an elector, and it consists of getting a phone call from the local Democratic Party boss in Pennsylvania where he lives, and he picks up the phone and the guy says, "Hey James, you wanna be an elector?" And he says, "Sure." And that was it. You know, so it's certainly true that these 538 people that are chosen every 4 years by no means are chosen for their political acumen or for their exceeding wisdom.
So suddenly these individuals, Gene Mazo, they are picked, somehow shuffled into the state capitol, and they said, "You're going to cast a vote for president." And boy, they're intoxicated with all of the options. And no wonder some of them say, "I want to vote for, you know, something kind of wacky." And they do some showboating.
Well, as George told you in the past, they haven't showboated. We had one famous, the first faithless elector, a guy named Samuel Miles in 1796, who was supposed to vote for Adams, voted for Thomas Jefferson instead. But all of these electors are what I would call grandstanding electors. In other words, they're just trying to make a point. They're not going to sway the election. We've had thousands and thousands of electors in our 58 presidential elections. Only 184 of them, some number around there, 184, I think I counted, have been faithless. And, you know, since the 1870s, we've had one every election. All of a sudden, we had seven in the election of 2016. So they just kind of came out of nowhere. I don't think people pay attention to them very much. But all of a sudden, scholars started looking into this. And now we have two cases that are before the Supreme Court where we have to decide whether states can control these electors or not. And this is very interesting. It's totally unprecedented.
And control them how? By replacing them if they choose not to follow their orders. That's basically how they would do that.
Right. We have two cases, as Jesse mentioned. The first case is called Baca versus Colorado Department of State. It's a case that was decided by the federal appellate court in Colorado. And there, a gentleman wanted to cast a vote for someone else, and he was removed by the Secretary of State. This is Mr. Baca. there were actually three faithless electors. The other two sort of got scared and voted the way they were supposed to.
So we're coming up against the clock, but so they went to the courts and they appealed, and the faithless elector was victorious, and now that's going to the Supreme Court. There's also another case in Washington with a different result, so this is something the Supreme Court is going to have to sort out for everyone. So we'll get more on that when we come back from the break. We got a bunch of callers on the board. We'll get them on the air. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. The source continues when we come back from the break. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about the Electoral College and faithless electors. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. George is on the line. George, thanks for holding on, and you're on the air. Go ahead.
I've read in the past, you know, very, very distant past, that abolishing the Electoral College would be a way to cause a civil war in the United States. Is that what they're trying to do?
How would it cause a civil war, George? Any more thoughts?
You would have just a few giant cities that are very dysfunctional would decide who would be our president, and the rural areas or smaller states would not have, or the majority of the area of the country would not have any representation.
George, thanks for that great call. Appreciate it. And again, the number is 210-614-8980. I'd like to hear from each of our guests on that. So let's start off with Professor George Edwards from Texas A&M. What about George's call?
I'm afraid George is wrong about that. It might be a cause for concern if a few giant cities dominated politics in America, but we don't have giant cities to begin with. And second of all, that wouldn't happen. As a matter of fact, if you look at what happened in the last election, there are 11 states, the 11 biggest states, could elect the president if they all agreed, because they would have 270 electoral votes. Now, Donald Trump didn't win the popular vote. He won seven of the large states. So if you're concerned about large state domination, then you shouldn't like the Electoral College, because that's what happened in 2016. The large states overrode the smaller states. So that's what happens in the real world. It is also the case that the large states, if you add up, take the votes of the 11 largest states and look at all the elections, for example, in this century, which I have done, they come out almost even. They are about 49-51. It's never been the case that the 11 states have given more than 51% of their vote to one of the candidates. So there's lots of competition. It's not one-sided, and there's really not a danger of that happening in direct election. There's much greater danger in the Electoral College.
Right, but Jesse Wegman, a New York Times editorial board member, author of the forthcoming book, Let the People Pick the President, the case for abolishing the Electoral College. There are people who think that the system we have now is one that creates some sense of stability, and so they would be reluctant to abandon it.
You know, and I understand that argument. Anything that's been around for a long time has incumbency going for it. But, you know, George's concern here is one that I've heard a lot, and that anyone who writes about or thinks about this issue hears a lot, which is this idea that somehow the rural/smaller states of America, and I don't want to equate those exactly, because I think people often conflate the ideas of small and rural, which is not always necessarily the case. California has lots of rural areas, and those rural voters, presuming that they would vote for a Republican, get no representation because they're outvoted. But I just want to add to what Professor Edwards said. He's absolutely right that the country is far more competitive in far more places than I think most people realize. But on top of that, even the real harm that's being done here is the winner-take-all rule. And that's a rule that 48 of the 50 states currently use to allocate their electors every 4 years. And once again, just to be clear, this is not a part of the Constitution. There is nothing in the Constitution that tells states how to allocate their electors. All it says is the states will decide for themselves. 48 of 50 give all of their electors to whichever candidate wins the most votes in that state. Even if they win a single vote more than the runner-up, they get all of the electors in that state. That obviously redounds to the benefit of the large states, right? So, you know, Wyoming has 3 electoral votes. California has 55 electoral votes. Are you going to try to get California's 55 or Wyoming's 3? I think it's really important to realize that the states that benefit under the Electoral College are not big states. They are not small states. They are battleground states, which are the closely fought states, especially the larger closely fought states, such as Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, where a swing of just a few votes, a few thousand votes here or there, can move all of the electors from one candidate's column into the other. So I think when people say rural America will suffer or urban America does better, you know, I just think there's that fundamental misunderstanding. I would also say I just think I'm not worried about, you know, if you're arguing, as I do and as I think Professor Edwards does, that the most important thing is the popular vote, I think the popular vote matters no matter where people live. It's wherever people live, they're going to vote the way they want to vote. And people don't vote based on the size of the state they live in. They vote because they're a Democrat or they're a Republican or they're an independent. And so I just think that's really the key. That's what we got to keep our eye on here, is that people vote the way they vote regardless of the state they live in. And anyway, the states don't benefit from the Electoral College the way that people think they do today.
And Gene Mazo, election law scholar and visiting associate professor at Rutgers University, what do you think about the idea that, I mean, just as an election law scholar, changing these election laws, usually that creates a lot of energy. People have vested interest that they want to protect, or they want to swing things in a way that will benefit their point of view, right?
Well, let me add something to what Jesse said. You know, in terms of getting rid of the Electoral College, whether you're in favor of it or opposed to it, it's not easy to do. We've had 27 amendments to our Constitution. 10 of them came in 1791, in other words, the Bill of Rights. So we've really had 17 amendments since then. The only way to get rid of this Electoral College is through a constitutional amendment, other than the George and Jesse referred to before, the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which is this idea that the states will award their electoral votes to whoever wins the popular vote. But that compact, that idea, has so far had 16 jurisdictions that have adopted it. They equal about 196 electoral votes, so we're still 74 votes shy. So whether we want a popular election or not, the question is how you get there, and this is not an easy question to answer. We have run 58 elections under the Electoral College. How we would adopt a popular vote situation is something that people debate. I'm sure it's in Jesse's book, but this is something that's worth thinking about. People get upset. We also, this is another point to make, to add to this. We don't know who would win a popular vote contest. You know, journalists called me after 2016 and they said, well, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote contest. Yes and no, we don't have a popular vote contest. What we're doing is artificially tabulating the votes in all of these states. The campaigns were looking to get electoral votes. If we had a popular vote contest, we don't actually know from a social science perspective who would have won that vote between Donald Trump, let's say, or Hillary Clinton, or any vote in past elections. Because if you think about it, the campaigns would do entirely different things than they do now. They would campaign in a different way. They would campaign in different places. Right now, the only contest we have is an Electoral College contest. And the campaigns know that. And so they go into states, and Jesse's 100% right about this. They go into states which are bellwether or metronome or flip states. In other words, North Carolina, Ohio, Michigan, Florida. It would be better to have a popular vote contest, but we don't actually know what the outcome would be. And for callers that are skeptical of the Electoral College, that's something to think about.
Let me go to another caller. This is Art. Art, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering, along the lines that if a delegate can, you know, being decided whether they can change who they're supposed to vote for, Could a state then decide that they're not going to go along with the popular vote if the legislator wanted to say, we're not going to assign it to the parties to send their delegates. We're going to change it this time, and we're going to send the delegates I want to send, kind of thing.
Okay, Art, thank you for that. So Professor George Edwards, can states make some big adjustments on how they deal with the Electoral College?
Well, states can select whatever electors they want, and they can also choose to distribute them as they wish. So, as I think Jesse said, 48 of the 50 states have decided that it would be winner-take-all, so they would give all their electoral votes to whoever comes in first, even if they don't get a majority of the vote. And that is the biggest problem with the Electoral College, and that's the one that creates the greatest disparity in translating votes into electoral votes. So that is a big problem. But states have an option. So two states, Nebraska and Maine, have chosen to have the option anyhow of dividing their votes. Now, there are small states that don't have a lot of electoral votes, but they can. And occasionally it happens. In Barack Obama's first election, the area, the congressional district around Omaha in Nebraska, went for Obama. So he got one electoral vote out of Nebraska, which is otherwise a very Republican state. So this is just an illustration that states do have a lot of discretion, but there is no mathematical way that states can make changes which will accurately mimic the popular vote.
And did Nevada change their rules at all after Barack Obama won that one electoral vote, Professor Edwards?
No, it was Nebraska.
Nebraska.
And no, they didn't change their rules.
Right. Okay. But there was some, there's always chatter. After every presidential election, there's always chatter about the Electoral College, going back, way back to the 50s and all that. And no one's ever really happy about how this works out. Even during, after Barack Obama's reelection, some conservatives thought there was no way that would ever have another Republican president under the current Electoral College. And they tried to mount an effort to have Electoral Colleges divided up along congressional districts. And they saw that was a way in order to make sure that there could be, that's the way things work out when you talk about electoral colleges, a lot of room for theory and guessing and trying to game out the system. We're going to take another break. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. What questions do you have about the Electoral College and about faithless electors and whether or not a new system would better represent the will of the people? This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the Electoral College and faithless electors. John on Twitter writes, Republican senators strongly pleaded with those prosecuting the president during impeachment to let the people decide. They should put their vote where their mouth is and let the people decide who will be president by popular vote. Also, an email from Andres. It's important to keep electors from voting against what the people of the state have voted for. If there was no electoral college, candidates would only campaign for the ideals of the populous cities and not care much for rural communities. Maybe we need to look at how many electors each state has. And let's go. So that kind of goes to what you brought up earlier. I think it was Jesse Wegman that this is, if we change the rules, then there would be a response, you know, game theory. You're only seeing what the rules are reflecting now. But if it's a popular vote challenge, then Jesse, we would expect to see presidents running, candidates running different types of campaigns.
We absolutely would, as Professor Mazo said. Actually, I don't, not to promote my book too much, but the final chapter, in the final chapter of the book, I actually speak with several dozen campaign managers and field directors, ground game coordinators of the last two decades of presidential elections on both the Republican and the Democratic side. And I asked them, what did you do to win the Electoral College, and what would you have done to win a national popular vote? And almost to a person, the response really goes against this common notion that candidates will only campaign in the big cities and they'll ignore the rural areas. You know, they all said to me, of course we would go everywhere. When every vote counts the same, and when the person who wins the most votes wins the election, that is the basic way you run a campaign, is you go everywhere. So let's just take examples of what I think is the best proxy for what a national popular vote election would look like right now, which are the battleground states that we've been talking about, a place like Ohio, a place like, well, Virginia is not so much anymore, but, you know, until recently, Virginia and Florida. What you see in these states is that candidates, because these states are sort of effectively a popular vote election, they are every vote counts the same, the person who gets the most votes wins, the candidates go all over the state because every vote matters. It doesn't mean that they don't go more to places that have more residents in them. Of course they do, because, you know, that's how the population breaks down. But they're not ignoring the rural areas, or they're not giving disproportionate attention to the urban areas. They're going where people live. And it's an incredible mapping of how close you look at how they campaign and where they go and where they spend their money and where they spend their time, and it's almost exactly mapped onto where the population is. So it really gives the lie to this notion that candidates will ignore rural areas. As I said before, right now they're ignoring rural areas. They ignore rural areas right now because there's no margin in it for them. There's nothing to win, especially in a place like California, which is filled with rural areas. There's no point in going there because they know they're going to win. You know, the Democrat is going to win the state. It's a quote unquote safe blue state. And so all of those other people get forgotten. In a popular vote election, those people would get attention because every vote matters.
Let's go to our voicemail line and let's give it a listen.
Yes, Bennett. The United States of America is not a democracy. It is a republic. And the Electoral College is part of the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution can only be amended by three-quarters of the states and two-thirds of the Congress.
All right. So the idea that the United States is not a democracy, it's a republic, that doesn't really mean a whole lot. Some call that a crank idea that has gained currency within some spheres. Do you want to take that on, Professor George Edwards?
Well, a republic simply means that you've got representation, that you're not having a New England town meeting. So it doesn't really have direct implications for the Electoral College. Of course, the caller is right. That's the way you change the Constitution, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't try. I mean, those are just happen to be the rules that it takes to change the Constitution.
And Gene Mazo, we can change the way the Electoral College works without having to actually amend the Constitution. If the states were able to decide that they were going to allocate the votes according to their own popular vote, getting rid of the winner-take-all or allocating it via congressional districts or other ways, that there's lots of ways to do this.
That's right. I mean, currently, one of the problems with the Electoral College is, as we've said, 48 states determine electors based on who wins that state's vote. Two states, Nebraska and Maine, split their electoral votes by congressional district, basically, that is the easiest way to explain it. Of the 48 states that determine who wins the Electoral College vote, or who gets, you know, which electors get to vote in that state, they determine it by the plurality of the vote. So if you think about it, Donald Trump won something like, I think the answer is 304 Electoral College votes. But in a third of those states, he only won a plurality of the vote and not a majority of the vote. In other words, more people, you know, he won 48% of the vote or 47% of the vote, because remember, we also had Evan McMullen, Joel Stein in these elections, other third party candidates. So electors are being appointed by somebody who doesn't even win the majority of the state's vote. I mean, it's problematic. Also, interestingly, the states regulate these electors in various different ways. A bunch of the states, 32 states, have some law on the books about how the electors have to vote or whether they have to pledge their votes to a certain candidate. A bunch of states don't tell the electors anything. Some of the states try to punish the electors by penalizing them if they don't vote in a certain way. And a few of the states, about 10 of them, will actually remove an elector if the elector doesn't vote in a certain way. So we have this hodgepodge system, this federal hodgepodge system. Most voters in their own states don't understand the system or don't understand what they're voting for or who these electors are. There are problems in it.
All right. And so, George Edwards, what's a way, I mean, to trust that the people have in having a government that represents them, or we're going to have stability and be able to move forward with a functioning government? You know, are we on a collision course with losing that?
Well, the Electoral College certainly doesn't contribute to trust in government if you get a government that you didn't vote for, that most people didn't vote for. So it's hard to have a lot of confidence in that. And I think we've seen that. Putting all of Donald Trump's polarizing actions aside, the fact is that most people didn't vote for Donald Trump. In fact, Donald Trump got about 46% of the vote, and Hillary Clinton got about 48% of the vote. So in normal elections, you have an election, and the reason you have an election is to see who gets the most votes, and the person who gets the most votes wins the election. I mean, it would be very odd in the state of Texas if we had an election for governor. It was relatively close, but one candidate got 51% and another candidate got 49%. And we said, well, the one who got 49%, you got elected governor. You might ask, why did you have the election in the first place? So it doesn't contribute to trust in government to have a system such as this.
And Professor Eugene Mazo, what do you think about, is this going to erode trust in the government?
I think there's a strong case to be made that we should finally elect the president by popular vote. The question is how we get there. You know, most people, there have been five elections where the popular vote winner was not elected president. Two of those elections have happened in the last 20 years. So this is kind of on the minds of people. And yes, I do think it erodes trust in government because most people want the person to be president who has the majority support in the country and not somebody who has, you know, a little bit less than that. And that's happened now twice in 2000 and 2016. And this is where these movements are coming from to change the Electoral College. It's that people are upset about this. Yes, I do think it erodes trust in government.
And Professor Mazo, we've had changes done before. We used to not be able to directly elect our senators, and now we do. So change is possible.
Sure, the 17th Amendment, right, changed the way we elect senators. I mean, if you think about it, our system is not a direct system of government. So senators weren't directly elected. When we go to vote for the president, we vote, and then electors are appointed, and the electors appoint a president. If you think about it, we're now in the primary season. By the way we elect a president has stayed the same since 1804. The way we nominate candidates has changed radically over the years. But what we're actually doing is electing delegates to go to national conventions who will then cast ballots for presidential nominees. A lot of the you know, election mechanisms of our electoral system are indirect. The fact that the Electoral College is indirect is not what bothers me. What bothers me and probably most other people is that you have one result in the Electoral College and you have a different result in the popular vote.
Right.
And this is what's troubling about this whole system.
And real quickly, Jesse Wegman, Let the People Pick the President, author. What bothers you, real quick?
I mean, it's really the partisan nature of this debate. I don't think we make it sound partisan now. It seems partisan now because of what's happened recently. But throughout all of American history, there have been more than 700 efforts to amend or abolish the college. And I think that comes from every direction because people understand that they want their leader in a democracy to be the person who wins the most votes. I just don't think it's that difficult. And if Texas, I will just say, if Texas were to flip and to send all of its electors to the Democratic candidate, I think you would see Republicans very quickly coming on board with the popular vote movement because it would be hard for a Republican to win the White House without Texas.
Yeah, so Texas with 38 electoral votes, that would be certainly would change the entire calculus of how you get to the White House. I want to thank all of our guests, George Edwards, Texas A&M political science professor, electoral college expert, Jesse Wegman, New York Times editorial board member, author of the forthcoming book, Let the People Pick the President, and also Eugene Mazo, election law scholar, visiting associate professor of law at Rutgers University. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.